Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Anton Lucky is a Texan, born and raised in Mill City, a neighborhood in the southern part of Dallas.
It was reeking with drugs, gangs, all kind of adherence for kids who grew up in that neighborhood to be involved in situations like that. More kids didn't have an outlet in those kind of neighborhoods. So for me, you know, coming outside consisted of seeing, you know, drug dealers, potential gang members, you know, that kind of stuff. That was kind of like the neighborhood norm.
Anton grew up in the 1980s. He was a straight A's honor roll student, and his mom watched over him to keep him out of trouble.
My mother was a single parent. She worked very hard. She always instilled in me and my siblings this idea of work ethic, this idea of doing right, this idea of not being a participant in the stuff that we see once we went outside. But I think the neighborhood and environmental influences was just so strong that it suffocated that message once you left out the door.
And that's why, even though he tried to avoid the violence often found him.
Growing up, I had numerous situations where friends and loved ones were tragically affected by violence. I myself was shot one time in the leg from a drive-by. So I know the violence all too well. I know it up close and personal.
Very personal.
I co-founded a gang with some friends of mine, in my mind, to protect my neighborhood who didn't have a gang identity. As kids, we would fight kids in other neighborhoods or other schools that we went to who had already identified with gangs.
As a result, Anton's grades started slipping. He was getting in frequent fights in the neighborhood. By the time he turned 19, Anton was facing criminal charges.
I'll never forget when I did get in trouble and was standing in front of a judge, and that judge told me that I was a menace to society, that I deserved to be in prison. I remember in my head vividly having a discussion that said, "Judge, you don't understand, like, I'm from East Dallas, that neighborhood is rough, that you have to be tough, you have to be like this in order to survive. Like, this not really who I am. I'm really a good kid, but I had to put on this armor to protect myself, but that's not really who I am."
Anton was charged with possession of a controlled substance with the attempt to deliver, and he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. He says that moment, on May 21st, 1997, that moment changed his life, in large part because just 2 weeks before his sentencing, Anton's daughter was born.
If I ever had kids, I didn't want to be to my daughter what my father was to me. And that was absent, you know, because I didn't care why he went to prison, what he did to go to prison. I just knew he wasn't present in my life.
Anton still lives in Dallas, and he's turned his life around. So has the city of Dallas when it comes to the city's crime rate. Since the late 1990s, Dallas's per capita crime rate had been on a downward trend all the way through 2014, according to FBI data. So things were looking really good for the city. Until 2015, when crime rates began rising again. Things got bad enough that city leaders announced a major initiative in 2021. It's called the Violent Crime Reduction Plan. Police Chief Eddie Garcia.
Our ultimate goal is the reduction of crime with an increase in community trust. Both are possible and both are needed. We will strive for both, and now these concepts are not mutually exclusive.
Since then, Dallas has actually seen the kind of success that's not often in the doom loop that draws headlines. Violent crime is way down in Dallas, a 24% drop in the past 3 years. Here's Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson speaking to CBS News last December.
This will be a third consecutive year of overall violent crime falling in the city of Dallas, which is incredible. It's a very, very positive story coming out of Dallas yet again.
And according to a Gallup poll from just last summer, Americans now see Dallas, Texas, as the safest large city in the United States. So the key here is a strategy known as hotspot policing, where law enforcement focuses on specific high-crime neighborhoods as a prevention mechanism. However, this is a technique that's also often condemned by critics of American policing. But in the years since its implementation, the people of Dallas have largely supported this decision. People like Antong Lucky, who is now president of Urban Specialist, a Dallas-based nonprofit seeking to disrupt trends of violence and poverty in urban communities.
Most people who exist and who reside in these type of neighborhoods, their perception of police is probably different than the talking heads that you see on the nightly news, right? Because most people that we know, that we deal with, that we work with every day are wanting the presence of police. They do want police because they understand that's the only deterrent to violent crime that they see.
It's a sentiment that Dallas's local politicians share, like City Councilman Tanel Atkins, who told NBC Dallas-Fort Worth back in January, quote, "Residents are saying, hey, we don't see enough police presence. We are shorthanded. We know we're shorthanded, but we need more presence in order to make sure we've got a safe neighborhood," end quote. So today, we're going to take a deeper look at exactly how Dallas has achieved this with its overall reduction in violent crime. We'll also take a look at what overall actually means and where Dallas still needs to do quite a bit of work. Most importantly, we're going to ask what are the lessons that Dallas, Texas has for other cities across the United States. Well, joining us now is Alex Piquero. He's a professor of criminology at the University of Miami. He was based in Dallas until 2020 and actually helped draft Dallas's violent crime reduction plan. Alex Piquero, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Megan. Good to be here.
So take us back, first of all, to 2018, 2019. What was the crime rate and the kinds of crime like in Dallas?
It was pretty serious, and homicides were starting to increase, and not by just single numbers. And it was really interesting because at the time, the mayor, Eric Johnson, was very attuned to this. And it was really forward-looking of him. And what he did was he put together a task force that was designed to identify evidence-based non-policing strategies. And that was a separate component from what the police department was going to do. And they were focusing on outlining their own particular crime prevention strategy. Because we know, Magna, really well, is that when you are attacking crime and violence, it's not just the police. It's the police in concert with non-policing alternatives. One is a short-term, right now thing, and the other parts are investments in the future. And so our task force identified a series of different strategies that the mayor could help direct resources toward, that including cleaning and greening, teaching kids self-control, investing in community violence interrupters, and those kinds of things, while the police department was crafting out their particular violent crime prevention strategy. So that coordinated two-prong approach is very successful.
So, Alex, with permission, I'd love to actually slow this conversation down a little bit because we've got time to really dive into the details. So we'll talk about the work that you were a part of in just a second. But, sometimes, on the radio and the media, we talk about crime kind of generically. So can you tell me a little bit more in more detail when we're talking about violent crime in Dallas in that pre 2020 period? You said it was pretty serious and the crime rates were going up. Was it all kinds of violent crime? And was it throughout the city or were there particular neighborhoods where it was especially bad?
That's a great question. So it was primarily homicides and robberies. And when the public thinks about violent crime, that's what they're thinking about. They're not necessarily thinking about aggravated assaults in bars. And what we do know, yes, Magna, that the crime, especially violent crime, is very patterned. And that's why when police departments develop strategies targeting those areas, that's what they need to do, because they know it's not randomly distributed throughout the city.
And so what were you doing in Dallas at the time? Remind me, what was your position there?
I was a faculty member at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Got it. Okay. So did the mayor then just come to you, or did his office reach out to you and said, hey, we have this idea? I mean, first of all, how did that go down?
So what happened initially was that the mayor was going to put together a panel. I think it's 15 to 18 people from all over the city. And these included, I was the only academic on it. It was other people in the policy space, other people in actually in real estate, in the school board. The idea was to get a good cross section of people in the city who had knowledge about crime and prevention issues and who had a lot of experience in dealing with those things. And so I was reached out by the mayor's office.
That's a pretty big board, 15 to 18.
Yeah, you know, it's always a problem when you have so many people. But what I noticed in that board is that there wasn't one dominant voice. It was literally people who were laser focused on public safety. And when people can put aside their egos and this, that, and the other and focus on something everybody cares about, the task at hand was very focused and we did really good work, I think.
Okay. The reason why I'm asking about this behind the scenes stuff is because how a process unfolds that leads to a success is just as important as understanding the success itself, you know? So how can you tell me a little bit more about how the conversations went? I mean, was there a goal in mind at the beginning, like we're going to do hotspot police, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, or how did it go?
So there were two prongs, right? Because The police department was focused on their efforts and I was helping consult them on their strategies, trying to identify what are the evidence-based strategies and then how do you do that? So independent of that, our task force, again, was focused on non-policing strategies. And so we were focused on not just producing one of those, you know, blue ribbon reports that's going to sit on a shelf. Mm-hmm. We were focused on putting together a document that was very digestible, and it was very informed on what prior cities did, and also identified cost-benefit analyses. And so it was a really good document that other cities could then use to replicate in their cities.
Were there disagreements? Did politics play out here?
You know, in my recollection, actually not. I mean, there were things about, well, you know, should we do this? And, you know, how many are we going to identify? 5, 10, 20? And so Alan Cohen and I, who worked really closely together on this project, he runs the Child Poverty Action Lab. Alan and I were focused on what are the strategies that we know work very well and they're translatable across places and that everybody can say, without a political affiliation, no, that's too far left or too far right. So these things cut across the political spectrum, the things that we identified.
Okay, so we're going to talk in much more detail about those things in just a moment. So today we're trying to learn from Dallas's success in pushing down its overall violent crime rate. We'll also talk about where Dallas still needs to do some work, but that's all when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a look at the city of Dallas, Texas, and how it has achieved an overall reduction in violent crime for the past several years. I'm joined today by Alex Piquero. He's a professor of criminology at the University of Miami, former director of the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and he helped draft Dallas's violent crime reduction plan. So, Professor Piquero, let's talk for several minutes about the law enforcement side of things, and then we'll sort of see how that meshes with the non-law enforcement initiatives that the city started. So you said, first of all, that law enforcement was looking at evidence evidence-based methodologies to reduce crime. I mean, talk a little bit about what that evidence-based is and what direction it led them in.
Yeah, so the way we look at evidence-based is when you implement a particular policing strategy, what you're focused on is not just the delivery of how the police do that job, but also what its effects are and in terms of reductions in crime. But also, Meghna, that's also very important is you also want to focus on displacement. So just because you deal with crime and lower it in a particular neighborhood or a block or a series of blocks, you want to ensure that it doesn't travel somewhere else. Mm. And so the idea of, and when you think about hotspots, that's really what you're doing. And when you look at a city, you're identifying those places in the city where there's a significant concentration of crime, and then you try to understand what's going on that's producing that crime.
Okay, so in the case of Dallas, I'm seeing here that some research showed that 10% of violent street crime in particular at that time was occurring in about 0.05% of the city. So it was very, very concentrated. How did police actually then, you know, decide specifically where within that, I guess that 0.05%, they were going to increase law enforcement presence?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what the city does is it basically creates microgrids. And so you're dividing the city into smaller and smaller parcels or even blocks, and you're going right to where those hot spots are. And so a hot spot necessarily isn't like five blocks long. It literally could be half a block or one particular business or one particular park. And so you're literally narrow focus on exactly the locations. And then you have to understand, what is it about that location?
And what, so, I mean, the locations I'm seeing here are, like you said, they're as narrow as they could be, like 330 square feet, according to some reporting I'm seeing.
That's right. And so that's smart policing. You don't want to blanket the city where the city doesn't have any significant problems. So you're going to devote those resources right there to those areas.
Okay. And then the understanding of why those areas are particular hotspots. What did law enforcement learn?
Yeah, that's correct. So sometimes it's an apartment complex that generates a lot of calls. And so there could be something in that complex, whether there's a drug distribution network or something of that nature. Other times it could be a business that might have shady practices associated with it. Other times it could be a park where people congregate late at night, doesn't have a lot of lighting. And so that's why that fine grain analysis of looking at what the problematic places are and why there are people there who are congregating there. That's the intelligence that goes on in the background.
Okay, and so what did the increased presence then in those like micro hotspots actually look like? Was it more uniformed officers on patrol? Like, what was it?
So it's a combination of both those things. It's uniforms on patrol, but also there's a non-uniform patrol that's doing a lot of work in the background because they have to gather a lot of intelligence. You know, who are the people who are running the drugs? Why are there guns being sold here? Those are the kinds of things. So sometimes you see police presence and other times you don't, kind of like air marshals on airplanes.
Mm, okay. And then you said a minute ago something really, really important, that that map that law enforcement generated was not static.
That's correct. It could change weekly. And, you know, every morning, police departments and afternoons when they do their roll calls, they're going to look at where the crime was in the last 24 hours and what kinds of crimes are peaking in different parts of the city. So there's constant intelligence that police are gathering and that's communicated right to the officers on the street level.
Wow. Okay. So did this require an increase in the police department's budget, an increase in the number of officers? Was there concern, as you said a little bit earlier, that the ability to deploy officers in other parts of the city was going to go down?
So that's a great question, right? Chief Garcia and every chief in the United States will say, I need more officers and I need more resources. So that's a simple answer. But it's about being smart about how you allocate. And so, you know, you can take officers off of a particular area of detail and put them into this particular targeted area and then move them back around. And one of the things that we know in criminology is that when police go to an area, it's not necessarily that they're there for an hour. It's the idea is getting them in there and then out of there. And you're constantly getting would-be offenders thinking about where are the police going to be next. So you want to keep this element of surprise always in these areas. So you're constantly shifting around. And obviously the police department isn't going to publish in the Dallas Morning News how they allocate their officers on the street. But I can tell you that that's kind of like what happens behind the scenes.
Okay, interesting. And this is still going on in Dallas, as far as I understand.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, what you know, when you explain it clearly that way, it actually seems like a very straightforward way of providing law enforcement support in the places in a city that need it. Is this kind, like right now, is this kind of hotspot policing being practiced in other city police departments that you know of?
Yeah, absolutely. It was first identified in the academic literature by a professor who I learned from in graduate school named Larry Sherman, and he actually did this analysis in Minneapolis, where he found that basically a small proportion of the calls of the addresses in a city were responsible for over 50% of the calls. And so that's the general knowledge. Okay, well, if I can find those 5% of the addresses, and I can then maybe solve a lot of those calls for service. And so every major police department engages in some form of hotspot style policing, without a doubt.
Okay. So the timing of this is particularly interesting to me, Professor Piccaro, because, you know, you were describing what the crime rate was like in 2018, 2019, the actually following Mayor Eric Johnson's win of the mayor's office, the Dallas Violent Crime Reduction Plan is put together. All of this comes just as the pandemic does. As well. Yep. And in cities across the country, for a whole mix of reasons, we saw a big spike in crime. What happened in Dallas?
So Dallas, like every other major city, starting at the kind of the beginning February, March period of 2020 into the spring and after the killing of George Floyd and the social unrest that occurred after that, and then into the fall of 2020 and then into 2021, just about every major U.S. city saw an increase in primarily in homicides and aggravated assaults. And a lot of that carried into 2022. But then some cities, including Dallas, started to go back down. Dallas saw, has been seeing a sizable a drop in crime, a little bit higher than some other cities. And a lot of the things that Dallas, had to put on its shelf, literally when the whole world stopped, they couldn't do the kinds of proactive policing because, A, officers were being taken out of commission because of COVID. Several died. And then they experienced staffing levels. So the police department took a little bit of a hit. And then all of those non-policing strategies like, education, kids weren't mm-hmm. going to school. They weren't working their social workers. There was no prevention and intervention programs because people couldn't meet. So all of the things basically that we know work to help alleviate crime or reduce its incidence basically turned off. And then as a result of the pandemic waning and people getting better, those things then turned back on. And then Dallas really doubled down on those strategies.
Mm. Well, here is Police Chief Eddie Garcia on CBS News last December talking about the successes of the Violent Crime Reduction Plan.
Total violent crime in this city is below where we were pre-pandemic. Robberies, aggravated assaults. Murder still remains a little higher than it was pre-pandemic, but that is a phenomenon. It's occurring in a lot of places, but that is what our goal is.
Okay, so both you and he just mentioned this, that the homicide rate is still higher than anyone wants it to be. So here's a little bit more of what Chief Garcia told CBS News.
So the murder phenomenon that occurs, I'll say this, what would concern me is if violent crime incidents were going up, which they're not. We've had the lowest amount of violent crime incidents that we've had in 5 years. What would concern me would be if gun crime was going up. Right now, we have a 23% reduction in overall gun crime as it pertains to murder, robbery, and aggravated assault.
Okay, so Professor Piccaro, in all fairness, and I mean, actually speaking in terms of like, how would you measure what true long-term success here is in when we're thinking about the reduction of violent crime? Because if homicides are still troublingly high, like what is victory here or what is success?
I'm never one to declare victory and success until there are nobody's dead. Just because we have fewer homicides in any big city in the United States, those are still people's lives. They have families, they have friends, they have relatives. And so I think you keep the foot to the floor until you get things down as much as you can get them down.
Okay. So, but I mean, what does that mean though? Because I'm trying to get a handle on, is this just a forever change in policing and change in city approaches that's going to be needed? Or can we say that once a pattern is established, that at least violent crime is no longer a top line problem in a city?
Well, I mean, I'd love for us to see the violent crime rate of other cities around the world, like London and Sydney, Australia. And we're nowhere near that. We're always much higher. And so I think for cities, and this includes mayors and police departments and everybody who has a horse in the race, I would love to see sustained long-term commitment. And that has to come directly from the mayors and the county commissions and the city commissions, where they're focused on, we're going to continue to do this and we're not going to stop, period. We're just not going to stop.
Okay. So in a minute or two, Professor Picare, I want to talk to you with you about the non-law enforcement side of the initiative, because that's very, very important here. But one more point about when this all took place, because of course, especially in 2020, summer of 2020 and thereafter, policing in America came under renewed and intense scrutiny and criticism. Did that sort of national conversation, that national outcry, have an effect on what was happening in Dallas? I mean, you know, amongst the people who were coming up with the violent crime reduction plan, amongst communities, law enforcement, you tell me.
You know, I work with police chiefs my whole career in many different cities. And by and large, I can tell you that the men and women who patrol the streets of America are hugely committed human beings. They care about their community. They don't do it for the money. They do it because they care about the people in those places. And I think what the killing of George Floyd did for policing internally and then externally is it forced them to think about, look, it's not just what we do, it's how we do it. And that, I think, has shown a huge commitment by police chiefs all over the country. You know, when Eddie Garcia was the chief of the Major Cities Chiefs Association, you know, he stood up there and talked about the importance of data and the importance of trust and the importance of legitimacy. And he means it. And so do many other police chiefs around this country. And I think that that's what's now come out of that whole process is a re-looking and a retraining and a recommitment toward building that trust and legitimacy. But Megan, remember, it goes both ways. The police need the community to do crime prevention just as much as the community needs the police.
Mm. I wonder what the response was, as you can recall, from communities. I mean, particularly we're talking about communities where many of Dallas's black residents live. As they saw what was unfolding, you know, with the killing of George Floyd, and at the same time having this initiative to reduce violent crime in Dallas, was there any pushback from the communities or the opposite?
I think a lot of it was the opposite. And I've seen that here in Miami and lots of other cities, is that people want the police in their neighborhoods, especially the highest crime neighborhoods. People want help. And they look to the police to do that. And again, the important part here is the police need to do their job in a fair and equitable way. And by and large, they almost all the time do. But the people in those communities, they don't want the violence. They don't want the guns. They don't want the drugs. They want safe places where they can go out and walk around at 7 or 8 o'clock at night.
Mm. You know, it's interesting, Professor Picare, I wanted to ask you that on the show today, because as we were, you know, doing our background and reaching out to members of Dallas's communities that went through or going through this hotspot policing, we were trying to get a fair picture as to what the response was from folks. And we didn't find anyone who said, this is terrible, we don't want law enforcement in the places where there's high crime. We just didn't. We were unable to find that voice. They may be there, but it was tough for us to find. Now, I focused on policing because it's really, really an interesting part here, but it doesn't stand alone, right? You had said in the beginning there were important non-law enforcement initiatives that went along with this. Talk to me about a couple of them in detail. What would you say were the key ones?
Yeah, I think there are three. And the way I think about this, Megan, is I think about, look, there's a 15-year-old kid right now who is 1 foot away from picking up a gun and solving a beef that occurred on social media. There's a 10-year-old kid right now who in 5 years might pick up the gun. And then there's a 3-year-old kid right now who in 12 years will. So your crime prevention strategy is focused on each of those groups. So the intervention strategies are the 15-year-old kid right now. That's what the police are attacking right now. And that's also a non-policing strategy called community violence interrupters that the Department of Justice has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in. And basically the strategy strategy is designed to target kids who are in violent-prone situations or on paths to violence, where you use credible messengers, whether they're ex-gang members or ex-offenders who grew up in that neighborhood, who have the credibility of the streets, who basically are trying to talk kids out of making really bad decisions. So that's a non-policing strategy. Sometimes it works in concert with police departments. Sometimes they work independently, like the individual that you referenced earlier,
Antong,
in
yeah.
Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Another strategy is cleaning and greening. And this sounds so simple, but it really is very effective in lots of cities. Is you're basically tearing down dilapidated buildings, and you're making them new again. You're investing in parks, basketball courts, playgrounds, those kinds of things. They give people a different sense of where they're at. And then the other strategy is really that long-term strategy, and that is teaching kids self-control. I mean, I can't tell you the absolute number one thing we can do of helping crime prevention over the long term, and it also has lots of other good benefits, is getting kids to stop and think before they act. It is the most fundamental thing we can do. So when you put all of those things together, you're dealing with that 5-year-old kid, that 10-year-old kid, and that 15-year-old kid, and you're constantly doing all of those things interchangeably over time.
Is cleaning and greening a new way of talking about broken windows?
Well, so broken windows is a term that a lot of people think they know what it is, but it's really different than that. So cleaning and greening is really investing in places, because when you invest in places, Magnet, you're investing in people, and we can be smart on crime by being smarter on people and on places. And cleaning and greening is just one part of that. You're making an environment where people feel safe. People have things to do. They feel proud and prideful about the area they live.
It's a true investment in neighborhoods beyond just like making things look a little nicer.
Absolutely.
Okay. Alex Piquero, stand by for just a moment. We're trying to learn as much as we can about successes that Dallas, Texas has seen in reducing its overall violent crime rate. We'll hear from some community members when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're speaking with Alex Piquero. He's a professor of criminology at the University of Miami, former director of the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and he was also formerly with the University of Texas in Dallas. And we're talking with him because we want to understand how Dallas has made great strides in reducing its overall violent crime rate, down for 3 consecutive years, in fact, by a significant percent. And Professor Piquero, before we go forward, I just want to clarify something and check with you on this. There are, when we're talking about absolute violent crime rates, there are other American cities that have lower per capita rates. So we're focusing, though, on the rate of reduction that Dallas has seen. Is that an accurate way of putting it?
Yeah, that would be.
Okay. Just wanted to double check because sometimes when we're talking about rates and stuff that people come away thinking, well, but I know that, you know, Los Angeles has a lower X rate. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about bringing it down. Okay. So hang on with me for just a moment because I want to listen to one other voice that's been at work on helping reduce Dallas's violent crime rate, Patricia Allen. She's vice president of No More Violence. It's a nonprofit in Dallas that focuses on raising community awareness and providing support to families who have lost loved ones to violence.
I haven't lost a child, but I lost a student in children's ministry. DJ was 14 at the time. Apparently, there was a fight that had nothing to do with him. There were some guys came into an apartment complex, started fighting. One of them apparently had a gun. And I guess when somebody saw the gun, one of the young guys jumped in the car, took off. But when he took off, he did not see DJ, and he ran him over in his apartment parking lot, and he became brain dead.
Hmm. Well, despite overall violent crime in Dallas going down in recent years, Patricia says local communities can often still feel very vulnerable without policy changes that enforce justice or bring justice for victims' families. Meanwhile, she says, more police presence is necessary.
When the communities see the police presence in their community, they feel much more safer. But then we want them to know that they can trust us. We want the trust back with our young people.
Therefore, No More Violence partners with the Dallas Police Department. Their efforts include hosting basketball tournaments between local students and local police to help build relationships and connecting youth who've committed a violent crime with the parents of their victims.
We want them to see that mother in person that has lost her child. We want them to understand the effect of what has done to that mother losing her child so they won't commit that type of violence.
But ultimately, Patricia says the success of hotspot policing and reducing violence in her community depends and will depend on law enforcement's success in being part of the community.
Got to be able to hear the voices of what do they want, what they need, what are they singing? What can we do to help you? I'm putting it back on police again, unfortunately, because I want them to see we got to be able to connect with the youth in the community and the families in the community to have their protection.
That's Patricia Allen, vice president of the Dallas-based organization No More Violence. Professor Piquero, respond to a couple of things she said there about she still wants the police to connect as much as possible with youth in the community.
Yeah, I mean, that's critical, right? You just can't have cops, you know, kind of fly in and fly out. I mean, they're part of the fabric of the community. And that involves them, you know, spending time there. And there are events like this all the time, coffee with the chief, or, you know, here in Miami, they have a dog that the kids meet and ice cream and stuff like that. You know, that might seem comical to people, but that's real. Those are real interactions. I mean, I sat in an event one day with the Miami Police Department, and I saw an officer talk to a kid for over an hour. Mm. And that connection, and the officer didn't have to do that. It was the officer's own time investing in that child's life. And that is part and parcel of when we think about policing. It's about policing working with the community, not at or to the community. It's always part and parcel with.
Mm. She also says something very interesting about the arrests or the hotspot policing in and of itself aren't enough, that families of victims do need to see the overall, the later stages of the criminal justice system working for them in terms of, I guess, charges and prosecutions. What do you think about that?
Yeah, a lot of police departments, Magna, actually have actual officers and maybe sometimes non-civilian personnel who actually help a victim or survivor out through the entire process. They walk them through the court proceeding. They're thereafter to get them services that they need or direct them to where they need to go. And you have to take care of people who've been, you know, suffering the consequences of losing a family member or relative or spouse or something due to a homicide. And so those those kinds of resources and support structures are really important. And a lot of police departments actually continue that process throughout the entire criminal justice process. And then thereafter, they just do checkups on people, even a couple years later. Hey, how's things going? You know, you doing all right? That's really important for people.
So I want to go back to what you said before about, you know, this is, you're in it, not you, but a city, its leaders, its police department, and its communities have to be in it for the long haul, right? Because in a certain sense, Dallas has definitely proven that, because I understand that Professor Michael Smith at the University of Texas, San Antonio, I'm sure you know of him, Professor Baggero, yeah. So he also works with the Dallas Police Department on the plan, and he noted that most hotspot policing initiatives in cities don't actually last that long. They may be, you know, 3 months, half a year. But Dallas, he says, Dallas has seen the reduction in violent crime because this plan has been going on now for, I guess we're getting close to 3 years, 2.5 years at least. And that may have been the longest time or one of the longest periods of continuous hotspot policing in a U.S. city for some time.
That's correct. The work that Michael is doing with the police chief is almost groundbreaking in a way, in the sense of you have sustained people in their places, right? The chief's been there for a while. The mayor's been there for a while. And all of the people in the city are working together on this, and they continue to be there. And that's one of those things that we see in places where a new chief comes in or a new mayor comes in. They're going to have different priorities. They're going to have different, you know, things that they want to do. And so the sustainability is the thing I think that sets Dallas apart, but it's also the commitment from the top down. And that is critical in cities like Miami and Boston and Dallas that are doing these kinds of strategies. Broadly speaking, they are sustained and they're committed to it, doing it across individuals in different units.
But again, just to be completely, you know, fair and honest in our analysis here, we talked about homicide still being a major problem point in Dallas. And also I'm seeing here, this is reporting from KERA in Dallas, saying that business robberies have really, really gone up 60%. And about 60% of those robberies, this is fascinating, can be attributed to about three different groups of serial robbers that have been hitting different parts of Dallas. So, you know, one wonders if there's modifications to, well, I guess this isn't hotspot policing because these are people moving from different places to places to you know, for theft. But, well, I mean, actually, what do you make of that, that there's still major areas like business robberies that are problematic?
Yeah, and that's the tricky thing is that, you know, a lot of these crimes that occur independent of the ones most people think about when they think about violent crime, it's a lot of intelligence work that has to go on behind the scenes and then to find these individuals. And so, you know, that's not an easy thing to do, right? If it was so simple, every department would take care of it. So there's a lot of that stuff going on. But that shows you that once you can identify these people, you can really make a dent in a particular problem. And I think that, you know, and that the police department, I'm sure, is doing that kind of intelligence, trying to disrupt those networks. And it's not just in Dallas where that's happening. It's happening in lots of other cities as well.
How much did it cost? How much is this costing the city of Dallas?
I don't have a price figure on that, but it's not budget dust. I'll say that.
Not budget dust?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It's more than a dollar. No, it's a significant amount of money. Look, I mean, when cities have money, and you know this, I mean, governments have money, they have basically buckets. There's education, there's public safety, and other kinds of things. And public safety costs a lot of money. You have to pay for the officers, you have to pay for the training, you have to pay for the equipment. Then you have the crime prevention strategy. All of these things are millions of dollars. And so, but again, you know, you get what you pay for. And so when you put the investments in, you're going to see the returns over the long term. And that's a really important point is, you know, we're going to have short term, you know, ebbs and flows, and some crime types might go up, some might go down. There might be seasonality with respect to increases in the summer, but you're in this for the long game too. And I think that that's always an important point is, where are we now compared to where we've been? And we're better now than last year. Better now than 2 years ago. Let's keep moving in the directions we're moving.
But policing still isn't, it's not an uncontroversial thing in Dallas, right? I mean, that's never going to happen in any city. There's always going to be some tensions. And I just want you to respond to how, you know, there's another side of things here that, for example, the development of a major police training center, $150 million police training center near the University of North Texas at Dallas, has been incredibly controversial there. I mean, how do you see that vis-a-vis the successes that we've been talking about?
Look, you're always going to have people who are going to be very critical of the police. And it's okay to be critical when there's a time and a reason to be critical. But I think there's also a time where, these are individuals who are trying to help solve problems. They're trying to make communities safer. And we should support that and then also make sure that they're doing it in the right way. But look, you have to have training facilities. The training of officers now has to be different from when it was 40 years ago. Yeah, some of the things are the same. But look, there are a lot of people who have a lot of high capacity guns on the street. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in social media now that wasn't around 20 years ago. I mean, a lot of police departments right now have the real time crime centers where they're literally monitoring social media sites to see what's happening now that might bleed onto the street 6 hours from now. Then there's also virtual reality training, right? When you think about how officers have to walk into a situation, you want to get them in a virtual world where they're actually seeing exactly what they might walk into, not what they learn in the classroom. So all of this training, this equipment, this is about, better equipping and better training these officers so they do the work and they do it the right way.
Mm. It's interesting though, because local organizers who oppose the creation of this new training center, they've been reported in Dallas media as saying that, $611+ million was put toward policing in Dallas in the 2022-2023 city budget. They also say that police staffing numbers are actually going down in recent years. And they do point to the successes of the violent crime reduction plan, saying, well, the fact that violent crime has gone down in their eyes proves that the city does not actually need to put more resources into police training infrastructure.
Yeah, I respectfully disagree with that. I think you have to look. I've been in the Dallas Police Department. I've seen a lot of the equipment. They needed that investment and they needed that kind of training. Because, you also have to think about something. The Dallas PD is going to be, competing against other police departments in the area who might be paying more money or who might have better resources or better training or better opportunities. So in one sense, police departments are sometimes competing against one another to recruit and hire the best people, right? And that occurs in every business, right? People think about what am I going to get here? What's my investment and what are my long-term, career opportunities? And so talent costs money, but you also need the facilities to do the work. So in my mind, I think that seems to be money well spent. Granted, there's always things that you need to spend money on. And so they might get an infusion of dollars now, and then a couple years from now, other monies will go somewhere else. And so your mayors and city councils are constantly shuffling the money around to do these kinds of things.
Mm. So it seems, though, that based on what you've described here, Professor Piccaro, there's quite a clear, I don't want to call it recipe, but there's now a successful template, let's put it that way, that other cities are and can follow, using that very targeted evidence-based hotspot policing that's quite dynamic, right, and keep that going over time rather than just for 3 months. And then all the non-law enforcement things that you talked about, the cleaning and greening, the, intervening with young kids if they get close to, violent behavior or violent groups, that sort of community building, community buy-in, really partnering with members of the community, things like that. But I'm wondering if there's a big obstacle here for some other cities to go fully into what Dallas has done. And that is the political obstacle that many Democratic mayors face. And in fact, Mayor Eric Johnson in Dallas said he faced it so much blowback from his fellow national Democrats that he has actually recently switched to the Republican Party. And he explained to CBS News why.
I made the decision that I wanted to be a part of the political party that I believe takes safety the most seriously, and for whom that is a very important issue. And the Democratic Party, in my opinion, and there are some good Democrats, I will say that, and I don't mean to disparage any of my former political allies, but the reality is I felt very, very much isolated and on an island as a Democrat when it came to matters of public safety.
And he has received some criticism from fellow Dallas Democrats.
Dallas County Democratic Chair Cardo Coleman writing that Johnson has the gall to join a party so blatantly opposed to the values of Dallas is an embarrassment, not only to him, but to our community.
Professor Picchiaro, in the last minute that we have, I wanted to point this out because underlying everything that you said is a commitment by city leaders and a long-term commitment as well. How much are you concerned that these kind of criticisms from, you know, fellow mayors, other national party members can perhaps reduce a leader's enthusiasm to do this?
Well, I know plenty of Democratic mayors who support these kinds of strategies. And I think that the key here is, you know, public safety is public health, and it's human rights. And I think when people put party affiliations aside, they're focused on how can I improve this community? How can I leave a better mark of my legacy? And nothing is more important to me than making sure kids have a safe future and the communities are safe. So let's put the left and the right aside and let's focus on human beings.
Well, Alex Picchiaro is professor of criminology at the University of Miami. Previously, he was at the University of Texas, Dallas, where he helped draft Dallas's violent crime reduction plan. Professor Picchiaro, it's great to have you back on the show, and thank you so much for walking through what Dallas has achieved.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.